Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for a child to piece together an identity when her life is split between two parents living thousands of miles apart? When Lee Newman was seven, her parents divorced, and she went with her mother to live in Baltimore, which offered great schools and cultural opportunities, but was a world away from the only life she had ever known in rural Alaska. She would return to live with her father during subsequent summer and Christmas vacations, and while she loved both her parents, the bifurcation of her most formative years left a lasting imprint on her ideas about herself and about the nature of committed relationships. Lee Newman is deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com. Her new memoir is called Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. Lee, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Chris.
So the time you spent as a kid in Alaska would strike most mainland Americans as pretty exotic, but I guess it never occurred to you as unusual before you moved away.
No, even when I was an adult thinking about writing this book, it was a huge leap for me to think that people hadn't grown up the way I had. I guess we all think everyone grows up the way we did. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about it much, but, you know, I grew up from a very young age living in the wilderness with my dad. He was a surgeon who lived full-time in Anchorage, but any free time we had, we were spent just jumping in a plane and going to the most remote places of the state, places without any roads, places where you could a lot of the time be sure that you might be one of the one or two people that had ever been there, you know, and walked around, because actually it's very hard for humans to get to these places, especially at that time period when I was growing up in the 70s. There just wasn't the same amount of access.
So talk about the archetypes that you describe as the great Alaskan dad and mom and child. What does that mean?
Well, yeah. When you grow up in Alaska, you always hear this phrase, great Alaskans. It kind of applies to everything. When they talk about the big earthquake that was 9.2, it's the great Alaskan earthquake. There's a lot of things like the great Alaskan lumberjack show now that comes to town once a year at the state fair, and they cut up all these things out of wood and make little chairs. And when I was thinking about my dad, you know, I grew up in this community where I knew that my dad was amazing and the most incredible individual ever, but I also knew there were several other ones like him, because we all lived on a lake, and many of the fathers were similar to my dad. They were different in their personalities, but in their presentation in the world, they were very similar. They knew how to fly an airplane. They knew how to pack a shotgun shell. They knew how to canoe down a rapid-filled stream. They knew how to catch a king. They were sort of Renaissance men in many ways, in that they knew every single detail that one needed to survive in the wilderness, and they sort of tromped around carrying us kids behind them. And they always sort of wore the same outfit. I mean, it was hysterical. You'd go to a barbecue, you know, and it'd be 10 guys and chess waiters with Stern's life jackets and Polaroid sunglasses and falling, kind of rotting apart woolen pants that they wore for like 6 months and a cigar stubbed in one end of their mouth, and they all had mustaches. So, but that figure, that great Alaskan father, who I definitely had, and he is much more complicated than that, but there's a special relationship with a child who has a father like that, because when you're out on the bush, dangerous things often happen, and the great Alaskan dad is often the one that saves you. He saves your life. He's watching. You don't think that he's watching, and there's certainly a huge amount of freedom as you're tromping around out there on the tundra, but he is often the one that will, you know, as I said in the book, you know, one time I just got out of the tent one morning and opened up the door, and there was a black bear about 2 feet from my face, and my dad just reached in, pulled me by the belt loop, yanked me back in the tent, zipped up the tent again, and sat there with the gun, just waiting to see what would happen. And when somebody does that for you, it really, you trust that person, I think, almost more than, it's beyond words. It's been going on since you were born. You know, there are pictures of me, we moved to Alaska when I was 3 weeks old, and there are pictures of me sitting in a playpen while my dad fishes for kings. You know, wearing, you know, little toddler outfit and just kind of playing there while dad fished. And so that relationship is some kind of ancient and primal in this way that is, it's almost a luxury, I think, because we've gotten so far from realizing how close we are to, you know, living and dying and thinking about those things in a very real, concrete way, not as sort of abstract concepts.
Yeah. Well, and then when the marriage ended and your mother decided to move away and take you with her, suddenly what essentially happened was that you had two childhoods simultaneous to one another.
That's exactly what happened. And it was very surprising to, you know, and my mother had grown up in Baltimore, Maryland, and she didn't have much family left there. Her mother had moved down south where she was originally from, but I think mom wanted to go back to Baltimore, and my mom had gone to a small private girls' school, kind of an Episcopalian school for girls, kind of a finishing school. And she moved back there, and she put me in a school like that. I wouldn't say it was a finishing school, but it was a prep school with uniforms. It was all girls. It was housed in the mansion of Jerome Bonaparte, with, you know, old barns and big stone buildings and a wonderful emphasis on the Western canon. And I really not only didn't know anything of this world, even just the architecture was astounding, just the sidewalks. You know, I remember seeing weather vanes, and just we would go in these neighborhoods. Now, not all of Baltimore is like this, but many areas are beautiful old homes, and I had never seen these, you know, stained glass in someone's home, or a weather vane, or a screened-in porch. These things were fascinating to me, and I began to live that one life there, where I was being raised and well-educated and introduced to things like horses and steeplechases, and quite frankly, because Baltimore's a little bit of a schizophrenic town, at the same time you had this beautiful life, you also had lots of urban poverty that I'd never seen before either. So I was living that life with my mother, and then I would fly 5,000 miles every 3 months to go see with my dad, and I would start just where I had left off. Dad and I never really changed anything, actually. You know, he did remarry, but we spent most of our time out in the bush. You know, he taught me how to shoot. He taught me, took me caribou hunting. We would go fishing for salmon. Eventually, he taught me how to fly fish. Always taught me how to fly the plane in case something ever happened so that I could, you know, if something happened to him while he was flying, I could take over and get us home safely. Which I never happened. Never happened, but highly aware of the Loran, the artificial horizon, and other gauges.
Well, you know, Lee, reading the book, it made me think a little bit of that old 60s movie, The Parent Trap, you know, with Haley Mills, and it's about twins. But it was just one of you, and yet you had to sort of switch on and switch off. And the way you cope with that when you were really young was just not really thinking much about your other life when you were absorbed in one.
That's very correct. That's exactly what I did. Somehow I had developed a mechanism where I was able to turn on one life or turn on the other. So if I went to Alaska, and it's interesting because I think it led to a feeling of isolation that I'm not sure in retrospect maybe was real. Mm-hmm. Because as I looked back in the memoir, as I was researching things and sort of looking back on my past, which I also had not done, I saw that, you know, kids at school, for example, in Baltimore had written me letters in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And I would not write them back. Same thing with my mother. It was like I couldn't see her face. I would try and think about my mother, and intellectually I would know she was my mother and I would love her, but I wouldn't miss her. It was this stuff time just kind of, it was like a jet lag of memory. You know, that 5 hours time difference between the two places sort of made my brain skip 3 months. So it was kind of distilled. And I think that, That stayed with me even, you know, to this day. I had to learn how to miss people. That was one of the things. Part of the book is about my relationship with my parents growing up in this way, and then part of the book is kind of a love letter between me and my husband, because he was the one that had to teach me how to miss people because I just didn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, as a kid, there was no point in missing somebody. All it did was make the agony worse because, you know, 5,000 miles is a long way.
It is a long way, and I do think it was a defensive mechanism, and I also think it was an acclimation mechanism, because in both places I had entirely different clothes to wear. You know, in Baltimore there was this whole preppy thing going on that I never really got the hang of it, but I did a fair imitation with the Fair Isle sweaters and the L.L. Bean boots, and in Alaska, you know, it was just jeans, maybe a shirt. I remember my dad took me in one time to the hospital when I was about 9, and I was wearing my standard uniform of overalls, and I had covered my overalls with Alaska patches, and I only like to wear these kind of boots that were called extra toughs. And someone came up to us and said, you know, Mike, she really needs to wear a shirt. And my dad was like, oh, yeah, let's get her a shirt. But when you're trying to figure out that way, you kind of have to land and acclimate. I mean, I remember exactly when I would land in Alaska, I would have certain pieces of clothing that I would keep in my bureau, and I would take them out immediately and not bring the Baltimore clothing with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that it was like a different personality, a lot of different things that would come out. I was much shyer in Baltimore. I was not able to express myself, and I was very intimidated by the children there who kind of all seemed to come from a life of great, I don't want to say normalcy, but a great ease, mm-hmm. and stability. You know, they had Volvo station wagons, and at that time period, even though their divorce rate was very, very high in the country, in Baltimore was somewhat like behind the times, and there weren't many divorced parents, and most of the kids had grown up not having neither the responsibility nor the freedom that I had.
Yeah, you talk about the fact that you had a lot less supervision in Baltimore than your classmates, but that had been something that had started actually before your parents split up.
Yeah, you know, I think that like many parents, well, first, it's probably dependent on character, like most things, right? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I was the kid. We, at the time that my parents were together, we lived next to the largest forest in North America, the Chugach National Forest, which is 1 million acres of just wilderness. And literally, I could ride my little pink Schwinn with my cowboy hat on, which I did every day, directly down the street to the end of the cul-de-sac, and then go into the woods. Mm. And when my dad would come home from work, even on very late, you know, we would go and collect rose hips and make our own tea. You know, we grew up in this way, and moose were constantly coming out of the forest into my front yard when growing up, and you had to be actually very careful of them because they could. Moose are actually a little trickier to deal with than bears because I think they're much more present around people, mm-hmm. and they're much less likely to run away. And they're often very hungry because the reason why they're coming down into the yard is they want to get a food source.
Yeah.
And people underestimate them and then end up getting kicked or charged, and that's very, very bad. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I grew up in this way, and with that came a lot of freedom. I think, A, because I was often interested in exploring. You know, I would take my fishing rod and I'd go down to a little, you know, probably polluted creek, now that I think about it, in the backyard and do all these things with my friends. But I also think at that time my parents' marriage was really falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a bad marriage, I think it is very, I never think it's intentional, but it probably is all you can maintain just to stay in the marriage. And at that time, I think I have very dim memories, and I have talked with my parents, but apparently people were constantly storming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the final break at 7 had been led to many times with people, my mom tossing me in the car and driving the Holiday Inn, then coming back, or my dad tossing himself with a VW van and leaving, and I think there was a lot of upheaval. And in addition, you know, my mom and dad were both grown up in a very tough way. You know, my mom had grown up with a mother who was an alcoholic and a borderline personality and in and out of mental institutions all of her life. And she had had no, her father had constantly been at sea as a sea captain. So I don't think she had much experience in, you know, telling me where to be or
nurturing.
How to, you know, so yeah. She was kind of learning it as she went also. We learned together.
Lee Newman is with us. She's deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com and author of the new memoir, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. We'll come back to the conversation in about 2 minutes. You can join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lee Newman. She is deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com. Her new memoir is called Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Lee, another big difference between your two lives was that your father as a surgeon, I guess, wasn't, you know, filthy rich, but had plenty of money, and your mom seemed to always be struggling. Can you talk about how that dichotomy affected you?
Well, you know, I think it's not an uncommon story that when couples get divorced, often the wife, especially the single, the child care provider, her income status suffers. I think they've even done a lot of studies on it. For us, I think it was a combination of factors. One was that, you know, I think my mother was very proud and did not ask for alimony at the end of the divorce and wanted to perhaps just, she had the idea that she could raise us on her own, but she was a social worker working in Head Start in Baltimore in 1979. Mm-hmm. And at that time, federal budget cuts were always about to lose her job, and she felt them very keenly and had to work two or three jobs just to keep us going. The other problem, so we had, and I did never spoke about it really with my dad. Again, those, that division but of my mind, I think I was also probably afraid that, you know, my dad would think I wanted money from him, mm-hmm. you know? And I was put in a position frequently of having to call him up and say, Dad, can I have money for lunch, or can I have money for shoes or things like that? But I hated doing it, and I tried to do anything I could not to do it. And that just meant me taking on all kinds of crazy jobs from, like, age 10 or something. I was working. I would do anything. I would babysit. I worked in a veterinary clinic. I worked in a kid's bookstore. I just did anything I could to earn my own way, which is a very Alaskan quality, by the way. That's that kind of self-reliance. You know, I was problem-solving it probably the way I would, you know, if I was on a riverbank, you know, going, oh, well, my parents aren't here. You know, I better figure out some kind of shelter for the night. And that same kind of thinking was, rather than ask anybody for money or try and figure out this problem, I think I'll just go get a job and solve it myself. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And that's also a lot of responsibility for a young kid. Things were sort of compounded, as we find out in the book, too, is that, you know, my mother's mother had a lot of mental issues, and one of them was a severe spending problem. My grandmother lived down in Alabama, and she would go into the department store, and she would buy, you know, $5,000 worth of, I'm not kidding you, ketchup and mustard dispensers, you know, knee-high socks, you know, plastic shower caps, and she also loved to get, for some reason, chocolates, assortments of chocolates with maps in them, mm-hmm. and she'd pack all that up and she'd send it up to Baltimore, you know, and your heart would sink because you'd know that she'd spent all the money that we'd sent her to live on this stuff.
Yeah.
And my mom, it took me a long time. I wasn't, you know, you the people that you love, and when you're a child, you cannot dissect what's happening, and I was not particularly astute. I also think after a certain point, I just stopped asking questions, but my mom was also suffering from some of those problems, and that she would go buy very expensive furniture and antiques, these beautiful, you know, with beautiful names, you know, Tiger Maple Low Poi and Queen Anne tables and Ball and Claw feet and all these almost evocative pieces of furniture that were like from another age. Mm-hmm. And they were beautiful, but I never really thought about where the money came to buy them. And I found that out later, and that was something I struggled with. That was a real betrayal. I had to try and understand how we could be poor and scrapping it, and that the money had gone for a lot of beautiful objects that somehow my mother in her mind felt so deeply that she needed. She felt that they strengthened her, but it was a hard lesson to learn.
Are there things you couldn't understand about your parents and how they felt about you despite mistakes they might have made along the way that you couldn't understand until you had kids of your own?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I was lucky. I know that I wrote a little bit of a different kind of memoir because I my parents made mistakes, but I always knew that my parents loved me.
Yeah.
You know, and I when I wrote the book, I sat down and the only way I could give myself permission to write the book was to be like, this is going to be a love story about me and my parents. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of flawed things that go on here, but I feel like with what everybody had in terms of their emotional resources and their and what they were willing to sacrifice, we all did this great job in living this kind of extraordinary situation with a family falling apart kind of cataclysmically across the country. And I do think that one thing I completely understand in deep, deep detail is with respect, for example, my father, you know, really felt that he was talking to me. He felt he was explaining things to me. I know that he did this. I didn't understand at the time because he was taking me fishing or he was taking me to go wild sheep hunting up a mountain and 3 weeks, you know, up on the shale ridges. And we just talked about sheep. It's not like we were talking about other things.
Yeah.
But he was trying, that was him trying to say, you know, I still love you, honey. And, you know, even though I've remarried, honey, you know, you're still a part of my life. That was him trying to explain things to me that we would be together. You know, he was talking through doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in his heart of hearts, he felt like he was talking to me, that he had explained things, that everything was going to make sense now. But, you know, I do that too. And I do it. I think that I've explained everything to everybody and that people know things. And in fact, even the memoir was a shocking process for even my friends and family, because when they read it, they knew almost nothing.
Hmm.
They knew I'd grown up in Alaska, but they'd never heard the story about the time the wind blew us up over the mountain and we almost fell out of the sky, or the time that, you know, we went down this canyon that was filled with rapids, flipped our raft over, and then kind of had to live for a couple of days trying to figure out where we were going to get food since all of it had floated away.
I thought it was really interesting when you wrote about, first of all, when your father remarried, you were sensitive enough, even at, were you like 10 at the time?
I think I was nine.
Nine, okay. You understood, even though this was kind of hard for you, and it wasn't so much personal about your stepmother, but you knew he needed to hear from you that you were happy about this.
Yeah, I did. I knew that he needed to hear he was happy, and I told him I was happy, and I continued to. You know, I love my dad, and I was afraid, I think, deeply afraid of telling him I was upset, and it was a mistake in retrospect. You know, I told him that I was there. I could see that my stepmother was kind of this very interesting person. She was extraordinarily loving, and she was nurturing, and she was maternal, and she did a lot of things that my parents didn't do, neither one of them. You know, she bought Band-Aids, you know? She bought Neosporin. She knew how to make a chocolate cake. Nobody else in my family knew how to do these things, you know? She understood what a fever was. She didn't yell. She was very, very soft-spoken and calm. And I was kind of bewitched by her, by the idea of her. But at the same time, of course, I felt, you know, guilt that my mother, that this was someone who was taking my mother's place. And then I felt afraid that if I spoke up about it, you know, my father would be angry and not talk to me. And again, when you get that great Alaskan dad, you have such respect for him that you're afraid sometimes to bring up things.
Yeah. Well, and then I also thought it was sort of charming that you were all prepared to really despise your half-brothers and then were instantly charmed by them.
Yeah, I was an easy, I'm a softy. That's the thing. My dad still says that. He's like, you're a softy. And it's the truth. You know, I took one look at those babies, and that was the end of it. You know, I loved them. And I think also I was an only child. So I had never really had that sibling connection. And I wouldn't say that these two half-brothers that were born, one was born when I was 12, and one was born when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And they both lived up with my dad, and they were both boys. And there was, you know, I was obviously in certain ways very jealous. They had many things I didn't have. They had fiscal advantages. You know, they had Patagonia pullovers and fancy skis, and they got cars, and they didn't have to worry about all the things that I'd had to worry about growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, it wasn't enough jealousy to anywise, like, impact my giant and humongous crush on them.
Mm-hmm.
I just, if they, you know, gurgled, I wanted to be there. And I actually reframed a lot of my life. You know, I went home every summer in college so I could be with them. I was their nanny. I wanted to be their babysitter.
So how did you find your way into, well, let's talk about college first, because I think it's really interesting. You write about, you made good friends, people were very kind to you, and then it almost seems like you would pull back the moment you got too close to people.
Yeah, I think that I had been, and I really do think this is one of the things, the most important things I discovered and thought about when I was writing a book, which is this this kind of self-reliance that develops when you grow up very independent from a young age. In many ways, it's a wonderful quality because you really aren't at a loss about a lot of things. So in college, for example, my dad had two young kids, and he didn't come down, and my mother was really struggling at that point with some of her own issues, some mental illness and some alcoholism, and she could not be that parent that would come and buy you toiletries and make sure you were checked into college. And so I often attached myself to other families, and they were wonderful. They would take me to the theater, and they would take me out to dinner, and they would take me to Duane Reade, or I think Target, that's what it was in college. And then I would be afraid. At a certain point, I would just shut down, because somehow I had, somehow being so close to this kind of loving family made me long for my own in such an excruciating way.
Hmm.
It's almost better to just do without. It's like if you're on a diet, do you go to the supermarket and look at all the luxury cakes in the bake?
Right.
You know, you don't want to do that. You want to just stay away from it so you don't get hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think in many ways, as I got older, after I got out of college and really began to live out in the larger world, this kind of self-reliance kind of turned into a little bit of a self-exile and a point that, you know, was not good. I literally could not get too close to people. I could not have friendships. I continually traveled. And the people that I was friends with didn't know very much about my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the traveling is really interesting. You found this this great job as a travel writer, great to the extent that you were young and you wanted to write, and you know. But you write about your travels and then the place where you actually theoretically lived, and it was almost an unlivable space.
Yeah, you want to say that it was because I didn't have an lot of money, because as marvelous as travel writing was, and I was traveling all over the place. I mean, I was going to the Galapagos. I was going to Nepal. My first story ever was actually, and it was due to Alaska, was I went up to the North Pole in Norway and lived with the Samis and traveled across the tundra with them and ate, you know, reindeer for breakfast and reindeer for lunch and then reindeer for dinner. And then right after breakfast, and on it went. Sometimes if they were feeling nice, they would give me a coffee can and tell me that I could collect lingonberries. I would eat those with the reindeer. The apartment I set up was in New York. You know, I guess it was, you know, I didn't really realize at the time, but I must have been somehow punishing myself or making it as inhospitable as possible, because I was living in kind of this dump in this very dangerous neighborhood, which was a big bustling heroin scene. I didn't allow myself to buy any furniture. I very much didn't want to be, was afraid of becoming like my mother and my grandmother and developing a spending problem. So I didn't buy any furniture. You know, whatever I found, I just found the street, or I would make it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not completely gone for me either. And I made most of the furniture that in my house now. I did. It's true.
Like carpentry kind of stuff?
Carpentry, like finding bits of wood. Well, I found like a big, giant railroad tie that weighed about 1,500 pounds, and then I put a seat on it, and then I made my own cushions that you can sit on it. And it looks very cool. It's not very comfortable, though. but it's certainly a statement piece when people come into the apartment.
Yeah.
And I never worry about the kids wrecking anything because we made it, you know, so they can wreck it.
So you weren't home a lot. I mean, how interested were you in dating at that early point in your life?
I think I had a longing, like most very lonely people I know. I had a great longing to go out with someone and for someone to love me back.
Mm-hmm.
I really did, and I didn't know how to go about it. I seemed to be attracted to a very few people that either cheated on me or I cheated on them very quickly. You know, and you think, and quite frankly, my lifestyle was such that people didn't really have the opportunity to ask me out. You know, I was constantly only there for a week or only there for 2 weeks. And even if I wasn't there for 2 weeks, I wasn't adept at social interactions. I had always been extraordinarily shy as a child, and after the divorce, things got much shyer for me. And by the time I was in my 20s, you know, I was the kind of person that could walk into a bar, literally, woman walks into a bar, who's a young woman, you know, young woman walks into a bar, I can sit down, order a glass of wine, I would just read my book or something. Nobody ever bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they didn't, you know, and
Well, it's funny because you once again, you had this dual life where I have to imagine you can't be that shy when you're traveling across the world to somewhere you've never been.
No,
and you have to meet people and form these sort of instant relationships to get your story written.
Yes, you do. And actually, that's the thing is, I would have to work myself up to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk on the book at this time with Russia, where I was trying to get into the Mariinsky Theater, and they did not want me in there to look at what happened to the ballet troupe after the fall of the Soviet Union, because things were rough in that ballet troupe. There was not enough money, and there was not enough food, and the dancers were working 9 hours a day, and they could only have like a small bowl of borscht if they could afford that. Sometimes they were working without even eating. And also it was just, I think, an odd bureaucratic rule that they didn't want me in there. But I had to sneak in there. But I remember, you know, I had to psych myself out in such a big way, even to ask the questions. But I do think I was great in a crisis. Anytime adrenaline had anything to do with it, I could perform. I could talk to people. I could make them like me. It was my job. And that's not necessarily true in your private life. I mean, I think we often have this dichotomy between what's necessary in our jobs or in our professions and then how we are in our real life or in our personal life. And I do know I had grown up very comfortable with adrenaline. Mm-hmm. You know, in that Alaskan background, you know, there are many, many times where the tent will flood or the plane will drift off and you're going to have to jump in the water. And I was very, very comfortable with managing adrenaline and moving forward. But when the adrenaline's not pumping and you're just sitting there saying, hey, I think I'm supposed to have a boyfriend at some point, or gee, I really want a friend. I mean, these really cheesy, you know, but fundamental things. Mm-hmm. Cheesy but fundamental. I was so rudderless. It was not good.
Lee Newman is with us. She's deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com, and she's the author of the new memoir, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lee Newman. She is deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com and author of the new book, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So at the last break, Lee, we left things sort of bleak, but let's get to that long journey home. You meet this guy that initially in the book you call Tender Intelligent Man. Talk about that.
Well, just because when I met him, you know, I wasn't ready to meet anybody, and we were at a party, and I don't even think I knew his name. I just sort of thought he had this nimbus of kind of tenderness and intelligence. He was talking about all kinds of things, and of course I wasn't listening. I was just sort of watching his mouth move, as one does when one thinks someone is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, when I met him, I gave him the wrong number and had to go back and change it. And his name is Lawrence, and half the book talks about my growing up in Alaska and this sort of love letter to this childhood I had, this extraordinary childhood. But the other half book talks about our love story, mm-hmm. because what happened was we got married, and then I left about 3 months into it. Almost immediately, actually. I think it was less than 3 months. I think we got married in late June, and by September 15th, I left.
What was freaking you out?
Well, I did not know it at the time. I had actually pushed for the marriage. I thought somehow that it was going to... I knew that other people got married. I knew that other people got married, and that I wanted to be like other people. But I didn't actually understand my own feelings about marriage. And actually, Lawrence had had a lot of misgivings about it, but he had spent a lot of time examining them. For me, once we actually got married, I think it was actually the wedding. It was the wedding. I did not want to have a big wedding. I wanted to go to Greece or just do something very small. He wanted to have a big wedding, and I wanted to give it to him. And the more the wedding grew and grew and grew, the more I began to panic and panic and panic. Of course, you know, being a great communicator, I didn't say anything to anyone. You know, I just talked about paper plates and daisies and mason jars and, you know, was my brother going to play the electronic organ? Like, how are we going to plug that in? Because we had our wedding in a very broken-down dairy farm that we rented. And then once it was over, I went away by myself for a little time, and I realized that I was not ready to get married. And in fact, that all I knew was I had this kind of hedgehog that was scrabbling around, and it was panic, this hedgehog of panic, and it was scrabbling around inside of myself, and I just went in. I said, I have to get out of here. I cannot be married. I am not ready. I'm sorry. It's a mistake. And it was not a great thing I did. It wasn't a moment I'm very proud of. But I do think it directly related to my fear of letting anybody get too close, you know? Because, you know, if I left him, then he could never leave me, right?
Yeah.
That's really what it is. I mean, it seems so obvious, but it's not when you're in it.
Well, it's almost like you got married and then you needed to prove to yourself that you didn't need him to live. You know what I mean? Like you could be without him somehow.
That is a kind of, you know, that does, yeah, that's a good point. That I could still do it, right? Mm-hmm. I could still function. And it's true, the only thing that I did take with me, and I took it under duress, was my dog, Leonard. And I had adopted this street mutt who was, you know, stinky, large, rude, and bit everybody. And, yeah, but he did boogie board on my back. I taught him how to boogie board on my back. But I took that dog with me, and he was my anchor at a time when I felt like I guess I wasn't even really worth being around other people.
Yeah.
Because when I left Lawrence, it was not one of those wonderful things where you meet divorced people and they say, oh, we were in a horrible marriage, and then I left and it was so much better. I mean, when I left Lawrence, I knew that I loved him, and he was a wonderful, supportive, great force in my life. And I left him, and I went straight downhill, you know. I did realize at one point as we were talking that, like, the moment that I left Lawrence was, like, the same age that my mother had left my father for the first time, you know, which was kind of shocking. My mouth kind of dropped open, and I thought, oh, boy.
Did you have a sense of it sounds like your parents were in a horrible marriage, but the grief that still sort of they must have felt at the dissolution of this thing?
Of the dissolution of my own marriage or theirs?
Of your parents' marriage.
I think they were very grieved. I think my father took it as a failure, and he doesn't fail at things. You know, his whole philosophy in life is can't live on Won't Street, and that's how he raised me.
Right.
You know, you keep going, and you keep going till you get to the top of the mountain. You keep going, and you keep going until you have knitted the whole sweater. You cannot, like, knit a sleeve of the sweater.
Which is good advice, but makes any kid crazy.
Well, it is. It's great in moderation, right? But I think, you know, that was hard for him to grapple with. And we came from a family of, you know, independent, frontier-minded people that had lived all over the West and had a very much, you know, you just don't quit. So when he quit the marriage, I think that was difficult. And for my mother, I think it was incredibly traumatic because she had grown up with such chaos in her own life. And I think maybe in the same way that I, you know, she had married this man, maybe thinking that it would not be like this again. And there she was, just like her own mother, raising a girl on her own, no husband around, doing it all by herself and struggling with the same issues. It was really like a trip back to the past. So it was very hard on her. I still think, though, she had wonderful memories of my father. You know, she still talks about those years. I mean, they had great adventures, floating down rivers. One time they ran into they were floating, and they bumped up onto a little bank, and there was a giant bush there, and my mom was in the front of the boat, and a bear, just a big giant grizzly, stuck out his head right in mom's face, and mom said, oh, hello, and waved while my dad tried to pull the boat and get them out of there and down the river. But if only my mother could introduce herself to a bear, you know, only my mother would have the social graces to do that.
So during the time that you and Lawrence were separated, your grandmother that you'd been very close to, not your mother's mother, but your father's, became quite ill.
She did, and I was surprised. I guess you never expect it when somebody you love gets suddenly ill, but she called me on the phone. I was living by myself. I'd left my husband. I was feeling very alone and unsure. I wasn't really speaking to my parents about it either. Mm-hmm. I had not really discussed that with them. And because, you know, I had to make the exile go all the way, you know, not even include your parents. I not only left him, I left him all by myself.
Right.
But she called me. She said she wasn't feeling well. And then she hung up the phone. And then I called her back and she didn't answer. She didn't answer. And she'd had a stroke. And so I flew out there to be with her. And we got her out of the hospital. It was actually a moment with my father of reconnection where my dad and I were able to take her out of the hospital and care for her until she died, basically on our own. We didn't really have any help. As it happened, some of my dad's brothers and sisters were at the birth of another child, and they were all the way across the country. And so it became, if you ever have the experience to take care of someone dying, it really is a privilege. And I didn't understand what that was. I definitely lost someone who had been like a parent to me. In fact, I had lived with my Nana when my parents split up on this island that she lived in off the coast of Seattle. She had a very remote house in the woods, and I lived with her for a very short period. But taking care of her when she was dying ended up being this incredibly moving and bonding experience where we were able to talk about the past for the first time, both she and I, and say all those things you need to say. She had such great belief in me. You know, she really felt that I was this joyful person and that I was going to bring all this happiness to everyone, even as I was, I'm going, uh-huh. And meanwhile, I'm not telling her what, you know, what's going on in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe she saw something in you that you couldn't see yet in yourself.
Oh, definitely. She definitely saw something. She definitely had faith in me in that way. And maybe you only need one person. You know?
Yeah.
And she was speaking in the right way at the right time. It was a little fortune cookie that she was whispering in my ear. And I don't know where she had the strength to do it because her body was in such, was so ravaged. It was so hard for her just to even breathe. She was in extraordinary amounts of pain. And I did not know where she summoned the resources to help get me back on track, but she did.
So how, at this time, Lawrence keeps saying, we've got to get together and at least talk about the state this thing is in and bring lawyers on and all that. And ultimately, you guys decided to, spend a few weeks together to sort of put a cap on the marriage?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I think I was so consumed by guilt over what I had done, and he just would not quit. And I've never had anybody like this in my life, but, you know, he would just drive up and knock on my door. And I lived, at that time, I lived 3 hours away from him in Massachusetts, and he was living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, okay, look, let's have a meeting and talk all the lawyers and figure out everything. And he would drive up and say, hey, let's go to a movie. Or, hey, let's go get hot dogs. Mm-hmm. Or, it's the fall leaves are falling. We want to go drive around and look at fall leaves and not talk. We literally would just drive around for hours and say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then stop and eat humongous quantities of junk food. Anytime I saw Kentucky Fried Chicken, I'd be like, pull over, we got to get Kentucky Fried Chicken. We get a giant box of chicken and just sit there and eat it quietly. But I think that it was some kind of way where he was going to reconnect with me. And it all ended up him ultimately coming on this cruise with me to Mexico, where I was supposed to be doing a travel story on Baja and the wildlife there, and he went with me. And actually, that ended up being the moment where we really thought things were going to be over with. There's a lot of people in love on a cruise, and if you're not in love, you don't want to be there.
Yeah, there's a scene where you're, like, sitting at this table at dinner with, like, all these retirees, and somebody says something about, oh, every room has two beds, and isn't that horrible for you? And you guys just kind of didn't say anything. And all of a sudden, like, they were trying to help you both?
Yeah, the cruise was filled with people. I don't think there was a single person on the cruise that was under 75 years old. there had been a miscalculation, and none of them could eat. But that they were all, many of them had either been in wonderful marriages or they'd been married for 40 years, and this was a big cruise. It was a big deal to them. They were totally bummed out because it was kind of a rustic cruise, which no one had understood. There was no 24-hour room service. There were no ice sculptures.
Mm-hmm.
There were like kind of iron bunks that you could sit in that were very separate. And all of the elderly people were very bummed about this. They had brought all their own liquor, and they were drinking margaritas, and Lawrence and I are sitting there like the old people. Lawrence and I are sitting there like the old people, being like, oh, it's fine. Let's just go to bed early.
Mm-hmm.
And they really taught us a lot. They really did. That group of people showed us great compassion without speaking. Again, that generation knew, I think, knows how to understand things, and they came to our aid. They made sure that we were always busy, that we always had something to do, whether it was helping someone or playing pinochle or looking at, you know, seabirds endlessly for hours on the bow of this kind of little engine that could ship. But it was a real learning experience.
How did you realize the relationship was worth another try?
I think I realized it was worth another try when, well, I do talk about it in the book, when I saw Lawrence not quit. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wasn't a quitter in most things. At some point, it did occur to me that this was the only thing I had really quit. You know, I had really quit. You know, you talk about Kant lives on North Street. I had quit on this.
Yeah.
And I needed to go back and try and finish it, because it wasn't as if I didn't love him. A, I needed to challenge myself, and B, I needed to see him demonstrate this kind of, he was sort of like Don Quixote, you know, of marriage. He came in, you know, riding the donkey, being like, well, let's not give up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it really did open my mind to trusting him and at least trying. If I failed again, it would be okay, but I didn't, you know? We really did manage to make it work. It took 2 years, though.
Mm-hmm.
It took 2 years.
And now you are married. You have, is it two children?
Yes, I have two boys.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard to write this all knowing that they will read about your emotions, your mistakes, and everything when they come of age someday?
Well, no. I hope it's good for them, mm-hmm. because I wrote the book out of love, and I wrote this book out of understanding that, you know, my wilderness was not the only wilderness that people grow up in, and I think that just about everybody has some point in their life where they're feeling very, very alone, and they're standing on an X, and they have to decide, you know, north or south, east or west, him or her, me or my past, all these different things that we have to choose. And I'm sure my boys will arrive at that X, and they might not have anybody to talk to, or they might, and I hope they do. I hope it's me.
Mm-hmm.
But I want them to know that I did that too, you know, and that I thought about my choice and I didn't execute it with the grace I wish in retrospect. But feeling not alone is one of the most important feelings in the world. However you get that feeling of not aloneness, you know, whether that's through a book or a story or someone talking to you, it changes the whole game.
Lee Newman is deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com. Her new memoir is called Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. Lee, it's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.